John Lee Anderson, ladies and gentlemen, perhaps the high watermark of the podcast to date. I once responded in a question for a grant application I made over at a Curious Worldview podcast that the people I admired most were great adventurers, great writers, and great journalists. And the kicker naturally being that the best was a combination of all three. In John Lee Anderson, we have an exemplar of those three labels. And if you just listen past, say, 10 minutes, I think you'll get a sense for the adventurer. If you hear his details on how he wrote the Che biography, you'll get a sense for the great journalist. And then if you've just read anything that John Lee's ever written, you'll understand the great writer. So this really was a mighty moment for the Curious Worldview podcast. I've published up until about the minute 50 or so when he gets into all of the details for the work he did writing the Che Guevara biography. But then we get into a lot of his more contemporary work, his experiences as a conflict journalist, his experience with the narcos in Haiti, in Mexico, all around the world. Him talking about working at the New Yorker, a great anecdote with Christopher Hitchens, how he thinks about the media landscape over the next 25 years, and so on and so forth. But John Lee is such a fitting guest, I would say, for the Geopolitics and Power podcast. And so I just want to leave it there. I'm going to play the episode right now, and then we're going to chop it at about minute 50, where I encourage you to go to the Curious Worldview podcast, where the full episode is published. And the reason I'm doing that is just because this podcast here is where I post the episodes of a geopolitical nature that appear on a Curious Worldview podcast. But I want you to make the assumption with me that we in fact have more interests that overlap than just the geopolitics. And so to get the full sense of John Lee Anderson and then access to almost the 200 episodes of Curious Worldview, just click the top link. This is not a paid podcast. There's nothing like that. It's literally just me directing you to another podcast feed. It's my primary focus and hopefully the podcast that will eventually make it. So, with no further ado, the great John Lee Anderson. Welcome, John Lee.
Thanks, Ryan.
You were giving me some really interesting history about where we're seated before.
The Frontline Club, yeah. This is already, it's only, I think, 20 years old, but it's an historic place here in London. Became very quickly a hub for journalists, publishers, many talks in this very room with very important people. I think I seem to remember that when the Iraq War began and there was a schism within the cabinet of Tony Blair, who of course supported the war along with Bush, a group of senior civil servants, if it wasn't cabinet members, came here and announced their disagreement with the war. It was big at the time here in this room. When Julian Assange launched WikiLeaks, it was here in this room. When, you know, and so on and so on and so on. Many people have come in the room downstairs, which is sort of the bar, restaurant, hangout room. There's a paraphernalia from a lot of the members on the wall. Von Smith, the founder, has a, there's a camera there that has a bullet lodged in it. The camera saved his life. Von started out in the military, but turned to, out of a spirit of adventure, really turned to frontline journalism, which is when I met him in and his guys in Afghanistan when the Soviets were pulling out. And over the years, they did the most sort of frontline of television coverage around the world and all the conflicts. And in the end, after the eighth member of Frontline had been killed, he decided that was it, and he turned Frontline News into the Frontline Club. And so, yeah, this is the place.
Were you here when Assange announced?
I wasn't. No, I was in some war somewhere.
What was the chatter from your mates here about when he did that?
You know, initially, I think everybody was like, you know, Assange was the kind of glossy new thing, wasn't he, initially? Fairly divided opinion about Assange over the years. I'm not a fan.
Why is that?
Trump.
Okay.
You know, he helped Trump get elected.
Oh, so, right, because of the Clinton emails,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And, you know, so yeah. But let's not go down that rabbit hole particularly. It's not foremost on my mind. We just happened to be sitting in the room where he launched it. I had no problem with his, you know, initial decision to make things more public. But I think towards the end of his time out and about, he was working more to protect himself and to do damage to the what he saw as the American system that was out to get him. And by doing so, he basically put himself in the same camp with Vladimir Putin and helped get Donald Trump elected, which has done huge damage to the world. Yeah. So,
well, to switch away from the Frontline Club, you actually overnight it came out, the memoirish New Yorker piece you'd sent me. Hmm. And in it, there's a throwaway line, one which I'd heard you hint at in another interview, but I've actually never heard you expand on before. The year is 1970, you're 13 years old, and somehow traveling East Africa alone.
Yeah, it wasn't intended as a throwaway line. It's what happened. I grew up all over the world, wasn't very happy about returning to the States where we'd lived briefly when I was 11. We went to Indonesia, had to be evacuated, came back, I ran away a lot. And my parents, as a solution, asked if I wanted to go spend a year with my uncle in Liberia. I had an uncle who's a geologist living in Liberia, and I was happy to do that. And but I was a bit of an animal and wildlife nerd, and so I really wanted to go to East Africa. And I earned money by mowing lawns the summer before I went. And my parents and my uncle and aunt agreed that I could go to East Africa halfway through the year. In Liberia, I went to the international school, and there was sort of between my parents and my relatives, they knew someone in each East African capital, you know, that were supposed to look after me. And I got a charter flight. So I had just turned 14. A couple of weeks after my 14th birthday, I flew to Kampala, but it coincided with Idi Amin's seizure of power. the couple that I was supposed to stay with in Kampala turned out to be the sort of vaguest of connections to my, I forget whether my parents or my aunt and uncle knew them, but they were a pair of sort of curtain twitching middle Americans who didn't like Africa, didn't know where they were, and didn't seem to know much about anything. And I really disliked them. And in those days, I looked older than I was. I probably looked 16, but I would tell people I was 18. And when Africans asked me, I would tell them I was 28. Anyway, after a couple of days, this is, of course, pre-email, pre-cell phones, pre-almost everything. I told this couple that I was leaving and that I was going to Queen Elizabeth National Park, which is on the border with the Congo in the west. And they were sort of flummoxed, but let me go. And they didn't know what to do about it. So I just left. And I started traveling around on my own and got on a local bus. And my real plan was to go to the Mountains of the Moon. I was just going to use... Queen Elizabeth was just a stopping... A ruse, yeah. I was going to cross into the Congo and go into the Mountains of the Moon. Because I'd you know, nourished myself on... biographies of adventurers and explorers from the 19th century. And I had no sense that I couldn't do the same thing, nor any fear on that trip. Anyway, lots of things happened. I ended up going elephant hunting with a gospel minister whom I met because I camped out on my own in Queen Elizabeth next to a pile of poached animal skulls, I remember. And this white guy showed up with a local guy who was his sort of acolyte, Patrick. And, you know, I wonder what he must have thought. It's like, who is this kid? You know? Anyway, sure enough, they invited me over to eat. I get elicited my story. I was pretty guileless. Mm. And they said, well, we're going elephant hunting. Do you want to come along? So I said, okay.
Sure.
So I did. Thankfully, he didn't kill an elephant over the next week, but I saw a lot of Uganda. And went into a lot of amazing bush and went through a few roadblocks with crazy army guys, who were, of course, Amin's marauding soldiers. But I had very little sense of it at the time. Anyway, went on to Kenya, Tanzania, climbed Kilimanjaro, lied about my age to be able to do that. Went to Ethiopia, got into trouble there too. You know, didn't write, didn't call. Nobody knew where I was. And I was sort of eventually hauled back to Liberia, not exactly in disgrace, but with a seriously inflamed foot too, which according to the doctors, you know, I came within about a couple of days of getting it amputated.
Holy shit.
Yeah. It was just the first of several near amputations. As it turns out, I would be on a skateboard now if I hadn't been luckier, with one limb, I think. But I had a great time, and for me, this was really formative, and I always wanted to return. I didn't want to leave Africa, and I always wanted to return. So, you know, it led me to make several further attempts to get back to Africa soon afterwards.
So you're a pretty wild kid running away from home all the time.
Yeah.
But is it really the case you just walked out the front door one day with a bit of money in your pocket and got on the bus, was wild camping, was traveling with these people? How are you moving throughout the world, you know, as a 13-year-old?
So like I say, I had agreed to stay with these people, and they were American Foreign Service people in Kampala. And I did, you know, they picked me up at the airport. I went to their house, but then I left their house and I went to the square in Kampala where you got buses, and I got on a bus to Kasese or wherever it was. And then in Kenya, I did the same thing. It was a Peace Corps volunteer couple in Nairobi. And I told them I just wanted to go down to Tsavo Park, which is on the border with Tanzania. But really, I was going to go across the border and climb Kilimanjaro. It was one of my, on my list, you know, which, you know, you're not supposed to do as a kid for whatever reason. And I did it. And I then, after Kilimanjaro, I wanted to go to the Serengeti. And I got a bus as far as you can go. I went to Olduvai Gorge and then to the Serengeti, and they left me. And I didn't have a tent. I had a bedroll. And I'll never forget, I had no money, right? So I ate whatever local people ate. And again, when they would see me, the Africans, they would say, "What are you doing here, boy?" You know, and I would say, "Well, I'm 28, you know, I'm just doing this." And they would, nobody ever tried to stop me. Mostly people tried to help me. And the Serengeti one was kind of funny because I slept near a kind of rock mountain one night. And for me, this was Eden. And I'll never forget, you know, going to sleep with the sound of the rock hyraxes, these little like marmots, you know, that inhabit those rocks, and waking up seeing elands and zebras in the near distance. And the next morning, I slept, I was happy, and on my own, entirely on my own, and walking along this dirt road. I wanted to go to Lake Tanganyika. It was, you know, a couple of hundred miles away, and it was a dirt track, really, through the bush. And I don't know how long I'd been walking when a Land Rover appeared, you know, cloud of smoke. Inside were these five or six, as it turned out, British scientists. And again, you know, they saw me, obviously stopped and said, "What the hell is this kid doing here on his own?" And I told them, I said, and they said, "Well, where did you sleep last night? What are you doing here?" You know, I said, "Oh, over there, you see that rock?" And they were saying, "Oh my God, you know, we're studying a pride of lions. We were about 200 meters away from you." Yeah. And they were heading to some bush airstrip and putting their lead scientist on a bush plane to go to Nairobi. And initially they said, "Well, you want to ride?" And I said, "Sure." You know, so I got in the car, and in the course of the car, Land Rover, in the course of the time rattling along, they convinced me to go with the scientists on this free airplane ride to Nairobi. So I was easily distracted, you know, just as I had set out for Mountains of the Moon and a guy invited me to go elephant hunting, I went with him. I was easily diverted from my plan to go to Lake Tanganyika by foot because I had a free airplane ride to Nairobi. And anyway, it was like that. And I just, I didn't have any fear. And I had a huge thirst for adventure, you know, and tried to live it wherever I could and whenever I could. And that was really all I wanted to do from the time I was pretty young. So when I said earlier that I ran away, I did, but it wasn't because I was angry with my family or wanting to cause them any anguish. I was a bit feckless. I didn't think about it.
Right.
The time I ran away in when we arrived back from Indonesia in California was I was heading into the mountains. I wanted to go live off the mountains in the wild like, you know, men I'd read about. And the police managed to catch me just as I was heading into the Sierras in one of the national parks. And then later in Washington, I ran away again. But that time it was to go live inside the Smithsonian Natural History Museum. Because before we'd gone to Indonesia, I'd worked there as a volunteer and I knew the place. And I thought that would be really cool to live, you know,
absolutely
behind the exhibits and all that. And anyway,
didn't make it. Did you pull off any nights in the museum?
No, because I convinced a friend, Andy, to go with me. And on the way there, we were hitchhiking to Washington. He said, let's stop and see my grandpa. He's really cool. He'll be fine with it. And I remember his grandpa very well. We stopped in and saw his grandpa, whose name was Poppy. And we were 13. Poppy gave us whiskey and cigars. And we were sitting there puffing these cigars and getting sick and drinking whiskey, which I'd never had before, when our fathers burst through the door.
Nice.
He turned us in. So we never made it. No, no. We were both hauled back home.
Have you ever been able to recreate the pure rawness of that adventure, 13 in Africa?
In retelling it, as I am with you, I've alluded to it in a couple of pieces, aspects of that year, because it's relevant. For instance, I returned to Liberia years later, so I've used some of my memories in the pieces I've written about Liberia from the earlier time. I had a means of comparison of what happened to Liberia between, you know, 1970 and 71 and after the wars began there. When I returned. So, but yeah, I have a very vivid memory of what it was like then, at least the Africa that I saw. So, but you know, I haven't written it in book form, but I've, you know, I remember it very, very well.
But I mean to say the purity of that adventure where there's no, you, like you say, feckless. One person says, come with me. Sure, I'll go with you. No care in mind about the destination. No thought about, can I even do this, etc. That pure rawness. Because obviously, you have a 1,000-page book full of adventures. But the pure rawness of that early one. Has any other time in your life you been able to recreate it?
Oh, I see what you mean. To live that as purely as I did then.
Because that's just pure adventure.
Yeah.
There's no end goal in mind.
I would say, I mean, and probably until I became a journalist and I began, you know, began reporting also with a spirit of adventure, but now, you know, for a kind of, for a purpose, you know, I continued to have, to mount my own expeditions to, you know, I went on to Alaska, then I was in the Amazon, and I continued to do things like this until I was well into my 20s. So, yeah. But that one was maybe the ultimate one because it was the first one where I was truly on my own in a continent that I was discovering for the first time that I'd always dreamed about and read about. And it was the sort of the best time ever. Yeah, you know?
As a prepubescent.
Yeah. It was fantastic. And when I see pictures of myself then, I mean, I didn't even have peach fuzz, you know, on my chin. I was, and the idea that I told people that I was 28 is just unbelievable that anybody actually thought it was true. Anyway, but yeah, it was a different time, and I was lucky, you know, I was lucky, maybe because I took people aback and they, the world, you know, it's easy to say the world was a different place then. Yes, it was. It's always a different place 20, 30, 40 years on from what it was before. And I suppose bad things could have befallen me, but, you know, they didn't.
Yeah.
By and large, the people I met were good people who, you know, probably kept their own counsel, but took me in hand and tried to keep me out of trouble, I guess. Mm. I realize now when I see pictures of myself, when I realize how young I was.
Right.
And I lived in a world in which there was no GPS, you know. My parents couldn't track me. There was no email. If you wrote aerograms and took them down to the central post office, and if you were lucky, they would arrive in their destination 2 weeks, 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
You know, nobody called anyone because it was so expensive. And if you had... You know, if you had a phone, in a lot of the world, there were no landlines. And so there weren't mobile phones either. So if you wanted to make a phone call home, you would have to also go down to the central telephone office in the capital of the country and book a call at what, for me, was always huge expense. And so you'd book 3 minutes for some prohibitive amount of money to talk to your parents or something. A week hence, or it would be a collect call, you know, which meant that they paid for it. I did a few of those, but not on this trip. It never even occurred to me to call them. Yeah.
All those details, no GPS, no one knows where you are, such a young boy, land you don't know. Like, these are all elements of risk.
Yeah.
Do you think that risk is a necessary input to it actually being an adventure?
That's a good question. I suppose so. I mean, I've never really been drawn to the kind of extreme sports that, you know, we associate nowadays with that. You know, bat wing gliding off of cliffs or,
stuff.
You know, surfing the monster waves or, you know, scratching the bellies of bull sharks or, you know, this kind of stuff. I just think I can understand why people do it, but it feels a little absurd to me. It's all about sensation. You do that for sensation. I love sensation as much as the rest, as much as the next person, but I've never felt the need to do it in that way. I have done some mountain climbing. I've done whitewater rafting. You know, I've done those things. But, and I think part of the thrill of the sensation obviously comes from an element of risk. But it's also about going fast. I suppose if the human body goes fast on anything, it's risky. Driving fast, water skiing, you know, any of these things. Skydiving, cliff climbing. You know, at one time or another, I've tried a lot of those things. But really, it was more, for me, it was more about exploration, I think. I wanted to experience what I'd read that the first explorers experienced.
Yeah.
You know, that was really what it was about for me. It was the discovery of the original world. So for me, the risk was never really something I gave much thought to. It was more about trying to experience what they had experienced. I could think of no higher ideal for me than that. For me, this was the ultimate experience, to see the world as the first men had seen it. So if it entailed risk, that was part of it, but it wasn't the main reason. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like some of these risk-taking adventures that people do today for the sake of the risk. No. And so when people have said later, because I went on to war and lots of wars, people who don't know war usually ask, invariably ask, oh, so you're an adrenaline junkie, or you get off on the adrenaline. And I have resisted that as well, because I think that's rather similar to what we're talking about, you know, tightrope walking between skyscrapers or something. It's like, no, I don't think I go to war to get shot at. No. It comes with the territory, but I wanted to see war because it's something men do that I think is abhorrent, and yet it's been an engine for history, and I want to see that firsthand. I think when I was very young, probably there was an element with some of these experiences of wanting to achieve manhood by proving myself to myself, like confronting fear and danger. So in that sense, yeah, a little bit of the element of risk, but it was again always a kind of abstract thing.
I completely project onto that notion you gave about the ultimate ideal would be to sort of discover some part of the world for the first time. You know, that explorer's ambition to truly stumble across something new and original and untouched, etc. What's the closest to that you've ever gotten?
Oh, it's happened a few times. When I was in Africa as a boy, apart from the East Africa trip I took several trips, what we called upcountry, into the bush in Liberia, which was very untouched at the time. Apart from one road which went to the middle of the country, there were just network of trails throughout the entire country. And in those days, you could effectively walk, not without danger, through the jungle on these network of trails, probably into the other countries too. And I remember going along one trail. I went with my uncle's cook, who came from an upcountry village. It took 8 hours to walk to from the nearest road by foot. And I stayed in this village. And from that village, we went. There were still elephants in Liberia at the time, and I wanted to see them if I could. There were very few. And we went on an old hunting trail that was so old that nobody'd been on it for years. You had to crawl because it was, you know, you macheted the vines hanging down.
Yeah.
And in this one section, you had to crawl. Nobody had been in it in who knows how many years. And we were crawling alongside the palisade of the bush devil's sanctuary. The bush devil is a figure who lived in the jungle. Each tribe had their bush devil who would periodically abduct the children when they came of age in the village and take them away to the bush school, which was this place where they would be taught the facts of life, jungle lore, get scarified and so on, and usually be returned with life to the village. Sometimes they never returned. Gross. And I really wanted to go to the bush school myself. But obviously nobody would let me go. But we were crawling alongside it this time. And I was in the village when the bush devil came and took three kids from the next hamlet. But on that same hike, we came through that bit and then into more open jungle. And then after some hours, reached a clearing, a very primitive clearing. When I say primitive, it was a few trees had been felled, you know, by axe. And there was a woman there with a child. She was cooking a lizard. And this child was maybe four or five. The minute the child saw me, it burst into screaming terror and did not stop screaming the entire time we were there. He had never seen an outsider before. It was four. It's happened to me with older people too. In the Amazon, when I was around 20, going up a river near the Brazilian border, tributary of the Ucayali in Peru. And we came across, I was in a canoe with a motor and a native guide, just me and him, and we could see in the distance two women with long black hair in a pirogue, you know, in a dugout, and they began screaming and waving paddles, and quickly got to the riverbank and ran. And when we arrived there, it was a very, you know, these were indigenous people, living very poorly, how should we say, originally. Can one still say primitively? You know, and it was gone. It was deserted. These were, I realized later, isolated people, people you would say are uncontacted today. That happened to me a few times, but we didn't have really terms for them in those days.
Right.
The Amazon, you know, you went up rivers and there were people who had never seen white people before. Or in this case, they were terrified and they kept screaming a word over and over again, which it took me some time to figure out what it was. But I could hear the word pishtaco. And I later found out that pishtaco was a term that was used by these indigenous people to refer to outsiders, a kind of monster figure who comes to steal the oil from your bodies.
Okay.
That's why they were so scared. And according to an anthropologist I met a couple of years later, his belief was that this had its origins in the colonial era when the Spanish conquistadors first came into the jungle and may have killed and boiled natives for the grease in their bodies so as to grease their muskets. And that this had sort of remained as a kind of terrifying myth and folklore throughout the Amazon. And whenever certain groups felt threatened by incursions, the outside world coming in, this sort of mythology was revived as a means of defense. Indeed, 2 years later, they killed people on that river. They went from being frightened when I went up to being aggressive and hostile 2 years later. So it's possible. I could go on, but I mean, you know, yeah, I do remember. I have seen glimpses of the original world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned the word luck a number of times. Through circumstances, you were lucky to, for it not to have gone a worse way, etc. Luck, by another word, is serendipity. As you look back on your life, your career especially, what is the role that serendipity has played in your life?
I mean, I you know, I'm not sure. I think there's a lot of determinism in everything we do. I think I've had, you know, I've had bad things happen to me. I haven't always been lucky. I have been unlucky too. But I've been lucky in the sense that, you know, unlike some friends of mine, I haven't been, I've been abducted, but I haven't been abducted and killed. I have been shot at, but not shot. I have been, you know, I've been in car crashes that haven't been fatal. So, and so on and so on. I've nearly drowned, but not drowned in the sea, you know? So is that luck? I'm not sure. Is it? Yeah, maybe it is luck or serendipity. But in each case, I used my wits or previous experience to save myself. So, you know, luck, yeah. But I don't know how to put a percentage on it.
Think about forks in the road. One in a million chances. Had you not gotten on the tube that time, that morning, you would have missed this opportunity. Moments of serendipity that drew in a certain direction.
I had a few. There was a period. I remember, actually, I do remember now that you bring that up like that. There was about a six-month stretch in the 80s in Central America where basically three times I was on a plane or a chopper that either went down right afterwards, shot down, or crashed. Wow. Yeah, repeatedly.
Yeah.
It happened 3 times in a row. And that, I guess that was luck or destiny.
Exactly.
Yeah. And those felt like close calls at the time.
Yeah.
But I remember remarking on it at the time and thinking, maybe I shouldn't get on helicopters, or maybe I shouldn't. But, you know, that kind of superstition stuff, I carry it for a little while and then it goes away again. Yeah. I'm not really that superstitious.
Are you religious?
No.
Do you subscribe to the notion that we're just bags of meat and bones?
No.
And once we're done, it's done? Or is there another element?
I don't know. I would like to think that, you know, our spirit counts for something. You know, that this idea, this notional spirit that we carry counts for something additional to the bag of meat and bones. I don't think we're only that. But I also don't think that it's, it doesn't seem very sophisticated to go through life and think, when I die, I'm going to go and like bask with the angels on some cloud somewhere. It doesn't feel very realistic to me. We go through life adhering, most of us or many of us, to this idea of reason and the factual base, the scientific world. Mm. Well, there's no scientific basis for the idea of heaven or God. So I don't personally believe in it. However, I've been around the world enough and with enough different types of people to realize that that idea of hope, really, or call it faith, is important for people, for many people. It gets them through life. It gets them through difficult times. So I've gone from being sort of probably pretty intolerant about that, especially with the more orthodox religions, to more tolerant of it over time. And I have met people who are people of faith, nuns, priests, who are really good people, wonderful people, who because of that faith, have decided to give their lives to others. And that's an extraordinary thing to witness and to be near.
Right.
I respect that. I especially respect that it tends to be amongst faith-based people, not exclusively, but this idea of living amongst the poor or in some horrible remote place and risking one's life, giving up the comforts one has born with to help out in some even small way, people who are less fortunate, I think is extraordinary and worthy of my respect. So if what's led them to do that is some kind of faith in a supernatural, fine. You know, I don't particularly go there, but I respect it.
Yep.
When it's obvious that they are good. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think that having a faith is the only way to be good, but I have seen that it's a way for people to structure themselves and their lives within a frame of goodness, and this is an old-fashioned term, I know, that I can recognize. I do recognize good and evil.
Right.
You know, I do adhere to those notions. I have met good people and I have met evil people.
Yeah.
I don't, whether or not it's politically correct to use that terminology, I have no doubt that that's the case.
Good and evil.
Yeah.
I think that hasn't quite yet made its way into unpolitically correct speech.
I think evil is something that people don't go around talking, using the term, because really? They think, yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't. I think it's been
like
expunged.
It's just a relativism.
I think it's been expunged. Yeah. I mean, God almighty, you know. Look at the op-eds about that try to explain why this or that despot or torturer or serial killer is the way they are.
Mm.
It's like, I'm sorry, but you know, at a certain point, you are what you do. So that's evil. If you've committed evil, you're evil. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have to be a, you know, a Baptist to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah. You don't have to morally explain away everything. It's okay to just say that is across the line. Therefore, I'm in a pickle, John Lee, because, you know, there's so many directions I'd like to take it, but I have to triage the time for questions. An anecdote from your life, which I really think is incredible, is the first time you actually see your byline. It's at the Lima Times. You stroll in off the street. They put you in a conference room and say, just write up a couple memoirish experiences, and these can be your first publications.
I had I was in Peru trying to figure out how to stay on there, because I was doing these sort of self-initiated trips to the Amazon and wanted to do more.
And how old are you at the time?
I'm 22, I guess. And I saw the Lima Times was this little weekly newspaper that had been going since the 1860s. It was kind of, it was begun by British expats, and you know, there it was over 100 years later, still going. And I saw an ad in it saying, we need reporters, or reporters needed. So I thought, I can write, you know.
Yeah.
Not really, but my mother was a children's book author. I had always, she had always encouraged me to write. I had a little newspaper when I was 10 in Taiwan. It didn't last very long, and I'd written a few things. So I thought, well, I'll, and I'd always aspired to write. So I walked in, and I told the editor that received me that I was answering the ad. And I think I said something like, I can write. And he said, well, sit down, tell me about yourself. And I think probably in the same way as those scientists in the Serengeti, they probably saw this callow kid who was, you know, completely guileless and, you know, I was burbling probably about my Amazonian trips. And he said, well, why don't you, you know, go sit in our conference at the big table, nice room, and just write up your experiences. And I did, and they started publishing them. And it was a huge thrill because, yeah, as you said, it's an extraordinary validation to see your name in print.
Right.
And I think what they did was they just started reeling me in, you know, at that point, and sort of trying to teach me the carpentry, the tricks of the trade of reporting, and gradually gave me more, you know, gradually gave me some reporting assignments. So that was sort of, yeah, that was the beginning. I've run across some of those pieces lately. I have four of them. I later did other pieces for them, but these four jungle chronicles, really. And it's interesting because I had no real knowledge of craft at that point, but I had a sense of story. And, after 40 years later, I see that, I mean, the writing could be improved, but the consciousness is there.
Right.
The awareness is that the perception is the same. And I think it's the same perception I've always had of the world.
You really recognize that person.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly, you know, I still remember the first time I looked out of a sandbox. I must have been about a year and a half old and saw the world. I remember the moment.
Mm.
It's one of my, I think it's my earliest memory.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's something.
Yeah, it is. And I'm quite sure it's real. It's not one of those told memories.
Yeah.
because it's just a very primary, you used the word pure before, I guess pure moment where I looked beyond the sandbox and I saw the world, and I was suddenly aware that there was a world out there. And you can see this in little kids at the moment at which they're kind of having a growing spurt. And they suddenly are more aware. They have a bigger radius around themselves. And I think it was that moment. It's not a memory with dialogue or anything much, but it's the moment at which I perceive the world. And I'm pretty sure I look through the world with those same eyes today, just with more experience. That's all. Yeah.
You said it's self-initiated trips into the Amazon. Hmm. What does that mean?
I mean, I just... I went to the Amazon. You know, I just took myself to the Amazon. Yeah. I went on my own. It wasn't for... This is before anybody was talking about ecotourism and these things. Mm. I wanted to go into the... I wanted to see the original world. Mm. So I pitched up in places like, a river settlement that you had road access, like a place like Pucallpa on the Ucayali. It's the Amazonian headwaters. I asked around if there was a guy with a peke peke. These are these long wooden canoes with a long shafted propeller motor. So you can go up very shallow rivers. They call them peke pekes because that's the sound they make. I bought a shotgun, you know, that kind of thing. And I would say, let's go up that river. I would ask around, like, where is the, you know, the most remote place we can go. That's the kind of thing I did.
Did you ever read Lost City of Z, David Grann?
Yes, I did later, yeah. In fact...
How much did you love that book?
Oh, great. I mean, David's such a talented writer. What a wonderful writer.
He's amazing. And
he's amazing success he's had. So, you know, more power to him. We've only met once because, of course, I live abroad. I don't know where he lives. But
New
it's
York.
Like that at the New Yorker. Yeah. Funnily enough... about 4 years ago, I was in the Brazilian Amazon, actually Mato Grosso, one of the reserves of the Chavante indigenous people. And they pointed to some mountains in the distance, and they said, that's where Fawcett went down.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah. I was actually in the area where
that's amazing.
The whole thing went down, yeah.
So you were on El Dorado's doorstep.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That was cool. Hmm.
Forgive me if this is too sappy of a question, but have you, because at this point you're 22, you've got these self-initiated trips into the Amazon, you've documented this African story, you lived in Taiwan, Indonesia, like we're barely scratching at the surface here. Have you reflected on just how unusual your upbringing was and how it's informed you as you grew older?
Yes. I mean, I'm aware that it's different to other people's, but it's the life I've lived. So when I was young, I was very aware of it. And sometimes it was a bit of a problem because I grew up in 9 different countries. I went to, 12, 13, 14 different schools. And I was always the new guy. Yeah. And so in a new place, sometimes a new culture, a new language. And especially when you're an adolescent, you know, people get pretty judgmental. And I had this kind of big life and wasn't easily cosseted or regimented, you know. And so there were times I realized that my big life, especially if I was telling people about it, caused issues. You know, people would be... It would make them feel competitive. They wouldn't. They would not believe it.
Right.
So there was a period of time in which I just didn't. I probably didn't talk about my past or my life very much, you know, in order to fit in. But I am who I am. I mean, I always have been. So, but yeah, maybe a little bit larger than life, as a kid, you know, as a youngster growing up. So yeah, very aware. But my family was also different than other families. We had, you know, we were a multiracial family. I had sisters of, you know, other races who my parents adopted, and we were, that was fairly unusual for the time. No. Yeah, so I have a Chinese sister, a Costa Rican sister, my eldest sister's my genetic sister, but born in Haiti. And we, you know, there we were in Asia and Latin America and all over the place. So I guess we were unencumbered by feelings of racialism in my family, uniquely maybe as a white American family. I say that with, you know, sincerely. My parents were like, if they were one thing, they were deeply anti-racist. And that was my earliest kind of political acculturation, I think. And we lived it. And I was always very aware that we were different. But I took that to be my life. And I liked it.
And you've got a son? Do you have other children as well?
I have two daughters and a son.
How did you instill adventure into them?
I think, you know, it just comes with the territory. We, they were all born here in England. We moved to Cuba when the eldest was 4 and the youngest was 3 months. Mm. We lived there for 3 years. And then we moved to Andalusia, Spain, where we lived another 6 years. So the first 10 years of their lives, mostly, we were in Spanish-speaking cultures. I took them also to... that time I began reporting for the New Yorker and going to war. So I didn't take them to those places, Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on. But I did take them, you know, on safari to Africa, to Morocco. I've taken them on trips with me, either singly or as a family, to, you know, Brazil, to the Amazon, to Peru, to Mexico, and different places in Europe. So my kids all have, and to places in the States where we have relatives, that kind of thing. So they all have their own sense of adventure. I tried to be a little more...
Like a cool dad?
I tried to be a cool dad, but I also tried to be careful not to let them know how early I had gone off and done things. Because I'm aware that, you know, kids try to emulate their parents sometimes. That didn't necessarily stop them. But sure. One of the things that I should say is that going back to my year in Liberia with my uncle Warren and Aunt Doris, when I was about, I don't know what age, I found out my mother was... it was her and her brother, Warren, the one who became the geologist. And while we lived all over the world, Warren lived in Death Valley and Hawaii and spent a lot of time in Alaska and then moved to Liberia. And I idolized Warren because he was kind of a mountain man. Yeah. And he was deeply, you know, if you saw a picture of him, it looks like Ansel Adams or something, you know, John Muir, he's like... You know, looks like he was carved out of wood. And he I found out from my mother that when he was about 14, they'd lived on a ranch, and he had his own trap line and hunted. And when he was 14, they let him live in the mountains by himself for the whole winter.
Wow.
So once I found out that Warren had done that, that became something I could do, you see. So I then pushed the envelope. And remembering this, I tried to keep that kind of knowledge about my age from my son when he was sort of near the same age. Yeah.
He just takes off to Liberia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So it's there, you know.
Nice. First of all, regarding Che, do you think it's the case that it's the work you'll be most remembered for?
Makes me feel like my life is already over when you ask like that. I suppose it's the.
All right. The details for the type of investigative work and access John Lee had to go through to write the Che biography. He is the journalist that discovered that Che was in fact buried under an airstrip in Bolivia, for instance. And he spent time with Che's widow, Che's childhood friends. It truly is the definitive work on this person's life. You know, morality aside, interesting person. Don't get caught up in the politics of the left, right, of the communist, capitalist, all of these binary sort of takes on Che Guevara. I think you'll see that John Lee handles the divisive nature of Che very delicately and I think very well. And but there's a lot more than that you can expect as well. He talks about Haiti, he talks about narcos, he talks about how there's no more revolutionaries, Mexico, the New Yorker, Christopher Hitchens, a great anecdote there. Anyway, a lot more. It's the top link in this podcast descriptions, and I hope to see you over to Curious Worldview podcast.